So last week we talked a lot about, well, first we started with Matthew 5, 13 through 16, and talked about, you know, being salt and light in the world. And then we got into Matthew 5, 17, which is a little more of a hot topic. Do not think that I came to abolish the Torah or the prophets, or your translations may say the law and the prophets. Basically means I didn't come to abolish the Old Testament, the Tanakh. Torah and prophets is just a title there for the scriptures. Although at this time the canon was not set firmly in place. So whether it was exactly the books we have now for the Tanakh or not, he's speaking about Torah and prophets. He didn't come to abolish, but to fulfill. Okay, so any questions from last week? No? Okay. Did it make sense, everybody? Because I got an email from somebody who's new to the faith, and she was very... very pleasant and very humble about it, but she said she had a little bit of a hard time following. But did anybody else have that problem? I didn't. Okay.
No, but that's because I've heard you talk about it before.
So. Yeah, okay. Okay. Okay, so if nobody had questions, we'll move on. I want to fill out just a little bit more on verse 17, and then we'll get through the rest of the chapter here. But first... let's read 17 through 20, and I know we're going over some of the same verses here, but I want to take a little different tact on some of this. Do not think that I came to abolish the Torah or the prophets. This is Yeshua speaking. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Amen, I tell you, and your translations may say truly, I tell you, but the Greek there is actually derived from the Hebrew, amen. But anyway, it's a way of saying, this is an important saying, listen closely. Amen, I tell you, or truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or serif shall ever pass away from the Torah until all things come to pass. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, this one shall be great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees and Torah scholars, you shall never enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay, so we covered those last week, but does anybody have anything else they want to add, either an insight or a question? Okay, it seems, like I said last week, it seems pretty stark, doesn't it? That, boy, we need to be really careful here. But we... and we do need to be careful, but not in the way that it may seem when first looking at it. So Yeshua's teachings have always got to be kept in context of his greater teachings, right? Shalom, Kevin. I've heard people take Yeshua's teachings out of context. You know, at one point he says, I did not come to bring peace, but a sword, right? And what's he saying there? He's saying, your faith in me is going to cause others to hate you. Kevin, do you remember Mitchell? He sat across from us at the Passover Seder. And obviously, Yeshua came to bring peace. So sometimes he says things in a way that grabs our attention. Wow, that doesn't seem to make sense. It jars us, and we have to think about it. And he wants us to think about it, okay? He wants us to dig in. That's why he spoke in parables, it says, right? Who is really going to look into what I'm saying? Who's going to really think about it? Who's going to allow these sayings to open up for them new ways of thinking, new life, and so forth? Okay, so the first question, shalom. The first question is this, and forgive me for repeating some of this, but in fact, I'm even going to repeat some of the same verses from Hebrews that I talked about last week. But can Torah change? And before we decide, before we, as if it's up to us, before we find out if Torah can change or not, we have to be on the same page as far as what does Torah mean, what does it mean? Okay, let's look at Hebrews 7, 11 through 19. I mentioned this portion last week, but I don't think we got into it too deeply. Hebrews 7, 11 through 19. All right. Okay. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, okay, I'm moving to a different translation now just because that's the Bible I have in front of me. This is from the ESV. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, or the Torah, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek? Okay, so this is from the writer of the book of Hebrews here is talking about Psalm 110. It's doing an exposition on Psalm 110, and Psalm 110 promises a priesthood according to the order of Melchizedek. And the writer of Hebrews is asking the question, why did the psalmist say that there's going to be a priesthood according to the order of Melchizedek when we already have a priesthood according to the order of the Levites? Okay, the ones who are offering the sacrifices in the temple, and before that in the tabernacle, were from the Levites. Why now a promise for another priesthood? Okay? So, what further need would there have been for another priest to arrive after the order of Melchizedek rather than one named from the order of Aaron? Okay, and Melchizedek was the king back in Genesis. Oh, I didn't write it down. Is it Genesis 15? I think. But back in Genesis, Abraham meets Melchizedek. Melchizedek's the king of righteousness, the king of Salem, probably the name of Jerusalem before it was Jerusalem. So he's the king in that a king in that area, and he's a righteous king, and he's one that Abraham even gives a tithe to. He donates to this strange figure that we only hear about there in Genesis. And so the psalmist picks up on this character of Melchizedek and says that, like that king, there's going to arrive a priest after that order. Yes?
Genesis 14.
14, thank you.
17 to 20.
17 to 20, thank you. Okay, so why in Hebrews is asking why this new priesthood? Verse 12, Hebrews 7:12. For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well, or necessarily a change in the Torah as well. Okay? So here we see that a change is necessary. For the one of whom these things are spoken belong to another tribe from which no one has ever served at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord, meaning Yeshua, was descended from Judah. Why was he descended from Judah? Because he had to be a descendant of whom? Well, of Judah, right? Judah received the promise in Genesis 49, the messianic promise. And then more specifically, of course, David, who was of the tribe of Judah. So Yeshua was a descendant of Judah and a descendant of David. He had to be. The scriptures make it clear that a descendant of Judah was going to be the Messiah was going to be a descendant of Judah and a descendant of David. Okay? And in connection with that tribe, Moses says nothing about priests. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, and this is the quote from the psalm, You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. Okay, the Torah made nothing perfect. The Torah is righteous. Okay, the New Testament, we see it in Romans several times. The New Testament calls the Torah righteous, it calls it holy, it calls it good, but it also calls it powerless. Why?
Jesus is the living Torah.
Okay, Yeshua is the living Torah. And what does... Okay, the Torah is powerless because it sets out a standard of right and wrong, but it gives us no power.
Not achievable.
It's not achievable, and it also gives us no inner power to do the right over the wrong. It just sets it out. This is right, and this is wrong. Do this, don't do this. There's a blessing for this, there's a curse for that. But we're going to find that under the new priesthood, that we have the Holy Spirit given to us under the new covenant, through which we now have power, the power of a transformed life through Yeshua, to do the right and the wrong. Okay, so what the writer of Hebrews is saying here is that we needed a new priesthood, because even though the old priesthood was good, we needed something better, something that gave us power to do right as opposed to wrong. And so if we say we follow Yeshua, and yet we don't have an inner life change, we're not really grasping the fullness of life in Him. Okay? He changes us on the inside. Let's look at the next chapter. But also, just keep in mind, there is necessarily a change in the Torah. Hebrews 7, 12. We need to keep that in mind. Hebrews 8. 6 through 13. But as it is, Messiah, or Christ, has obtained a ministry that is more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. Okay, so here in Hebrews chapter 8, the writer is doing the same thing with Jeremiah chapter 31 that he did with Psalm 110. He's looking at a promise and saying, why this promise of something new, of something different, of something better, if the old was so perfect? Okay? So in Hebrews chapter 7, it's Psalm 110. In Hebrews chapter 8, it's Jeremiah 31. Okay, so Jeremiah 31, as you know, is in the Tanakh, in the Old Testament. I'm just going to say Tanakh from now on. For those not familiar with that term, it's the Jewish term for the Old Testament. Okay, so Jeremiah is in the Tanakh, in our Hebrew scriptures, and Jeremiah 31, starting at verse 31, promises us something better, something different. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord. Okay? When I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. So here in the Tanakh, God is promising a new covenant. Why is He promising a new covenant? Let's look at verse 32. Not like the covenant that I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my Torah, or my law, within them. We should say Torah there. Okay, since that's the Hebrew. I will put my Torah within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. What's he saying here? He's saying, I'm going to bring you a new covenant that is going to give you power to fulfill. Hebrews 8 says the Torah is powerless. It's powerless. Okay, it does a good job. It sets out right from wrong. It sets out righteousness from evil. Sets out blessing from curse. But it doesn't imbue you with the power to fulfill. And Jeremiah, as a word from the Lord, is saying, I know that you broke the covenant. I'm going to give you a new covenant that's going to give you power. Okay? The power to not break it. Okay? I'm going to write it on your hearts. I'm going to write the Torah on your hearts so that you will be strengthened. I will put my law, my Torah within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall anyone teach the neighbor and each his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. We haven't seen the fullness of that yet, right? We still need to tell people about the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. So this new covenant has to deal with the Torah being written on our hearts, and it has to deal with the forgiveness of iniquity and sin. And this is exactly the message of Yeshua. I'm bringing you a new covenant in which the righteousness of the Lord, the Torah of the Lord, will be written on your hearts, and I'm going to wipe out your iniquity through my atonement. He fulfills perfectly what we need in the new covenant as prophesied under the old covenant. And he does it in the order of being a priest, in the order of Melchizedek. Okay? Now the rest of Hebrews chapter 8 quotes Jeremiah 31. Now the text there in Hebrews 8 is a little different. It's not an exact translation of Jeremiah 31, but it's pretty close. And part of the reason that it differs a little is because it's pretty closely aligned with the Septuagint, which is the ancient Greek translation. But regardless, it's all the same points, all the same, just little variations here and there. But basically, you have there Jeremiah 31. But the last verse of Hebrews chapter 8 says this, in speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Okay? So Hebrews chapter 7 talks about, because we have a new priesthood, the Torah has to change. Hebrews chapter 8 says the old is becoming obsolete and is vanishing away. Okay, we'll have to talk about what does that mean, because Yeshua in Matthew 5 makes it sound like nothing changes. Every jot, every tittle, you've got to follow through on. So we have to make sense of this, and it's pretty exciting once we wrap it all together. Let's go on to Hebrews chapter 9, verses 23 through 26. Okay. Thus it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites. Okay, so what's he saying? In the old covenant, in the Torah, there was animal sacrifice and blood was sprinkled as a way of purification. Okay? But the heavenly things, continuing on with Hebrews 9:23, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Messiah has entered into holy places made with... Oh, I'm sorry. For Messiah has entered not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Let's drop down to Hebrews 10:1. For since the Torah has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Okay, so let's stop just for a second. We have here an idea of a shadow and a copy. And the shadow and the copy is the Torah. Okay? A shadow and a copy of what's going on in the heavenlies. Okay, it's the best we had. And it was good. What God gave Moses was a copy of what's going on in the heavenlies. The atonement that he was making there through animal sacrifice, a copy of atonement that would be made in the heavenlies. So when Yeshua says in Matthew 5:17, I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill, he's saying, I'm bringing in the bigger, the greater reality. Okay? I'm bringing in the Torah written on your hearts. I'm bringing in not the copy, not the shadow, but the reality of the good things that are to come. Okay, let me continue on in Hebrews 10, and then I'll see if there are questions or comments here. For since the law, or the Torah, has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sins? But in these sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins every year. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Okay, this is a problem if you just at first glance here. God tells us that the blood of bulls and goats does take away sins, that it does make atonement. Leviticus 17:11, for example, you need blood atonement. You need blood atonement. It does work. Why does it say here in 10:4 of Hebrews, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin? For that, we have to look at the the Greek, right? And it means to totally cut off. The blood of bulls and goats does not totally cut off all sin. That's why it has to keep being done. Okay? That lamb that you brought for your chatat, your sin offering, it provides some covering here, but it doesn't totally cut off for all time your sin. We're looking for a better priesthood. We're looking for a better tabernacle. We're looking for a better sacrifice. And all of these are found in Yeshua, who fulfills the Torah and the prophets. He doesn't abolish them. He brings them to their fullness. In bringing them to their fullness, there is some change, right?
Just meant to use the facilities.
That's fine. Right down the hallway there. So if you want the fullness of the Torah and the prophets, you have to look at Messiah. Okay. But in looking at Messiah, and these things being brought to fulfillment, the Torah cries out for something else. Okay, the Torah itself cries out for something else. It looks forward to the prophet like Moses, right? Moses says in Deuteronomy 18, a prophet like me will arise from amongst your ranks. It's looking forward to the prophet. It's looking forward to the perfect sacrifice. It's looking forward to the perfect heavenly tabernacle. And in that looking forward, Yeshua says, I'm bringing in the fulfillment. Okay, questions or comments? Does it make sense? Okay. Does it excite you? It excites me. Is it exciting? Or is it still percolating up there?
It's percolating.
Percolating. Okay. So, truly I tell you, continuing on at verse 18, truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or serif shall ever pass away from the Torah until all things come to pass. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches... Yep, I'm sorry, back at Matthew 5, 5:19 now. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, this one shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Okay, so... Well, let me read verse 20 as well. For I tell you that unless your righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees and Torah scholars, you shall never enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay. Do you know where else he says you shall never enter the kingdom of heaven unless this or that happens?
I think forgiveness and unforgiveness or somewhere...
So, for example, a little different wording there, I think, if we're talking about the same place, but, you know, we do see, like in Matthew chapter 6, after the Lord's Prayer, unless you forgive others, you won't be forgiven. So, yes, forgiveness is important. Also, we see that in Matthew 12:8. Nope. Didn't mean Matthew 12:8. Forgive me. Let's see here. Verse 20. Let's look at Matthew 18. Matthew 18. Let's start at verse 1. Matthew 18, 1 through 4. At that time, the disciples came to Yeshua saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Okay? The exact same wording there as in Matthew 5:20, "You will never enter the kingdom of heaven." 18:4, "You will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Okay? No, 18:3, "You will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Okay? So in 18:3, "Unless you become like a little child, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, a traditional understanding of 18:20, better than traditional, I should say, looking at this on the surface level, looking at 5:20 on a surface level, looking at 5:20 on a surface level seems to contradict 18:3. Okay? "To enter the kingdom of heaven, I have to be like a little child." 18:3. 5:20, "My righteousness has to exceed the scribes and Pharisees." What do you think of when you think of Torah observance and scribes and Pharisees? What do you think of?
Ostentatious.
Okay, ostentatious.
Extremely observant.
It's all external.
Okay, so all those answers are correct. Let's look at Marilyn's answer, though. What did you say again, Marilyn?
Extreme observance.
The scribes and the Pharisees, or the Pharisees and Torah scholars, however your translation says, they were known for being very detail-oriented. very detail-oriented. And not only detail-oriented, but doing like it says in the Avot, which is a portion of the Talmud, Jewish rabbinic writings. It says, make a fence around the Torah. And to them, that meant don't just keep Shabbat, but put a fence, put extra rules around keeping Shabbat so that you make sure you don't cross over that line. Okay? So if the Torah says don't desecrate the Sabbath, don't work on the Sabbath, they've got hundreds of rules on how to do that, right? Don't you can only walk this far, or you can't carry anything. Okay? I went to an Orthodox synagogue one day, and one guy wanted to, I don't know, for some reason he left the synagogue with his tallis, but he had to wrap it around himself a certain way so that it wasn't technically considered carrying the tallis. You know, for us, we carry our Bibles and our tallis and pocketbooks to synagogue. The Orthodox don't do that, right? So they have all these rules, and so at first glance, if he's saying, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven, at first glance, you might think, oh, I need to be really careful here. If I'm not really careful about how far I walk on Shabbat, or if I carry or don't carry, or I have to wait this long after eating milk before I can eat meat, or all these different kosher laws that go way above and beyond what the Torah actually says, then actually we're not looking at this right. That's not what he's saying, right? What he's saying is more in line with what Nancy said, right? The scribes and the Pharisees, now not all of them, okay, obviously. Paul himself in Acts calls himself a Pharisee, right? So Pharisee is not necessarily one who's being ostentatious or being hypocritical, but he is leveling a general charge against these people. You've lost sight of what it means to obey the Torah. To obey the Torah is a heart attitude. You need to start by being childlike if you really want to be Torah observant, right? And then he goes on to talk about anger and lust and divorce, right? And oaths and retaliation and love. He goes on to talk about these things to explain to them what he means by the fullness of Torah. Not going against a jot or a tittle of the Torah, not going against the smallest letter of the Torah, doesn't mean add on all these extra laws, make sure you're getting the minutia right. It means have the right attitude. Have the right attitude. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. It's a spiritual issue, and it should be a spiritual issue. If he's bringing in the new covenant, okay, what does Jeremiah 31 say of the new covenant? I will put my Torah on their what?
Hearts.
On their hearts. So it's got to be a heart issue. And so is there change now that we have the Messiah here in the Torah? Both yes and no. Okay? There's no change in the heart issues that the Torah was meant to teach. No change at all, because it comes from God. Yeshua came from God. The main stress is the same, but some of the way of getting there is different. Okay? So instead of animal atonement, we're going to have Messiah's atonement. He's going to bring that into fullness. Instead of our focus on the earthly tabernacle or the earthly temple, that's going to be destroyed not too long after Yeshua. Our focus will be on the atonement made for us in the heavenly tabernacle and our access into the holy place through his atonement. Our ability to come into the presence of God, okay? So we have a new priesthood that's going to be instated here through Yeshua. But the thrust of the Torah and the righteousness of the Torah is going to be the same. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, righteousness means obedience to God. Okay? Obedience to God. What did Yeshua say he had to do to fulfill all righteousness earlier? And earlier in Matthew, we talked about this. Let it be done so that all righteousness may be fulfilled. John didn't want to do it. Yeshua said, let it be done. Matthew chapter 3. Yes, the baptism, right? He is, there we have the word righteousness as well. Okay? But Yeshua answered him, let it be so now, for thus it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness. Matthew 3:15. You don't need to flip there if you don't want. He is submitting to the will of God. Your righteousness needs to be submission to the will of God. Torah observance is submission to the will of God. Okay? And it's a hard issue. Okay, so how is it the same? It's the same because it's still from God. The Torah is from God. The Messiah is from God. Obviously, the message is going to be the same. Be righteous. Submit yourself to God. Be a person of love. Be a person of good character. These things are the same. Okay? What's different? We already talked about some differences. The priesthood is different. The sacrifice is different. The priesthood is no longer the Levitical priesthood. It's the priesthood of Messiah and the order of Melchizedek. The atonement is no longer the atonement of the blood of animals. It's the atonement of the blood of Messiah. The tabernacle is different. It's no longer the copy of the heavenly tabernacle. It is truly the heavenly tabernacle. Okay? It is now a more inward issue. Okay? He's going to write the Torah on your heart. It's going to be a Torah with power, a Torah with the power to do the will of God. So if you are struggling with sin, you're struggling with an addiction, to whatever, smoking, pornography, lying, whatever, you now have a Torah with power. Okay, not just one, do this and you'll be blessed, do this and you'll be cursed. Not just a Torah with motivation, boy, I want to be blessed, not cursed. But an inward Torah through the work of Messiah to fulfill righteousness, to fulfill the will of God. Okay? And it's a more, it's also, we're going to find out later, a more inclusive Torah. Okay, a Torah more inclusive of the nations and of the Gentiles. Israel was always to bless the nations, right? They were to